Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning to our first program of October 2015. As you will recall, we have been marking the 50th anniversary of the Roundtable over the past several months. In March and April, we started with a series of programs, in March in particular, that sort of reflected back to the programs in March of 1965. And, you know, when we look back, and I've been doing a lot of looking back at those 1,600-plus programs, a lot of things change, a lot of things stay the same. But we could go on and on about that. We started in March talking to the mayor, as they did back in 1965, and then they spoke to the head of the Metropolitan Development Association, John Strolls, who was actually one of the founders of Thursday Morning Roundtable, along with Lee Smith and a couple of others. And at that time, they were talking about economic development and home base meaning like the five-county region. And regionalism was a big theme that actually they invited John Strolls back in October of 1965 to kind of give a progress report. Well, you might recall that in March, Rob Simpson came and spoke about economic development today and our home base. And we think about it a little bit more broadly. Actually, we were talking about this at Citizens Academy last night, right, John? That it's a lot more about trying to include the entire community and be more inclusive. So we go in that direction. But we still talk about the geography of regionalism, and we have regional economic development councils that we're hearing a lot about this week. And so today, I think we're kind of going to expand that conversation and, or get more specific about it. And to introduce today's guest speaker, I've asked Christina Callahan, who is the executive director at the Syracuse Airport Authority, to introduce today's guest speaker. So thank you, Christina.
Good morning, everyone. It's my pleasure to introduce Larry Brinker and New Air this morning, because what Larry and his team at New Air are doing, really leading the charge towards what we believe is going to be the future of aviation. Just to give you a little bit about Larry's background, it's quite extensive, so I've condensed it to some of the highlights. Larry attended the Naval Academy and graduated from the Citadel with a BA in political science. He then went on to earn his MBA from Southern Illinois University and a law degree from the Atlanta Law School. He retired from the U.S. Air Force with 25 years total active service and reserve service. Larry has held a number of public service roles, including a member of the South Carolina House of Representatives. Any House of Cards viewers out in the audience? I believe that's where Francis Underwood got his start.
And Rhett Butler.
Larry is an FAA-rated transport pilot with multiple type ratings with over 8,000 international and domestic flying hours. He is also an FAA-rated flight engineer and serves as an FAA aviation safety inspector. He can do it all as far as the FAA is concerned. With that, it is my pleasure to introduce Mr. Larry Brinker. But before I do that, I asked him, as we were emailing, if there was something about him that other people might not know about. And he told me that he once caught a pass from the NFL Hall of Fame football quarterback, Johnny Unitas. So I'll let him elaborate on that story. With that, Larry Brinker.
Thank you.
Well, thank you all very much for having me this morning. I'm Larry Brinker, the drone guy, and we'll get to drones in just a second, but I have to tell you my Johnny Unitas story. He's such a great gentleman. I was either 8 or 9 years old, and my dad took me to an NFL exhibition game. That was way back before television was big in NFL, and we did things in person. It was the then St. Louis Cardinals versus the Baltimore Colts, Johnny Unitas being the quarterback of the Colts. My dad had a friend who was one of the referees that day, and at halftime, my dad's friend asked Mr. Unitas to come over and sign my autograph book. So he did, and he was very congenial and talked for a few minutes, and he started to walk away, but he had my pen in his hand, and I was distraught because I had hoped to get some other autographs that day. So my father, being my father, said, hey, what about the boy's pen? And I was embarrassed down to my socks at that point. But then Mr. Unitas, being the gentleman that he was, gave me a smile, took a two-step drop, and threw me a pass with the pen, which I caught. I remember that forever. To talk about drones, I've brought a few friends with me today, and if we can get the audiovisual system to work properly, I'd like for you to hear from them first.
Drones are the new frontier in aviation.
The drone delivery business had what some are calling its Kitty Hawk moment, in reference to the town made famous by the Wright brothers.
A drone just might save your life someday.
In less than 10 years, drones like this one will be delivering emergency medical supplies to locations around the world.
These unmanned mini planes can also be used for very important environmental research.
Here in the U.S., the FAA is still working on regulations and standards for the use of drones like that one, but overseas, they're already flying in Africa over game parks, tracking wildlife.
Clients come to us weekly with some new idea to use on manned aircraft. It's going to improve lives, it's going to make things safer, it's going to give us perspective that we don't have standing here on the ground.
It's pretty clear that the next great wave of transportation is going to be robotic transportation, and that's going to require new industries, new jobs, and new research and development.
Our role is to pave the way for that. We're doing the testing. We're helping the FAA establish that it's safe. New Air is teamed with Griffiths International Airport as the test site manager. So we provide resources, we provide professionals, we provide expertise, we work with the customers.
The Griffiths facilities themselves have been outstanding. As far as the hangar we have access to, the runway we have access to, and the location we have our ground station, couldn't beat that. Griffiths has been top-notch for that for us.
Give to private industry is an opportunity to come fly and test. We offer great airspace and great ground support that can't be replicated anyplace else.
Having the ability for Central New York to play a leading role in the development of this industry, this means economic development and this means jobs. The growth is basically limitless. And this is the frontier of aviation.
It seems the sky really is the limit.
We're the New Air Alliance, and that stands for Northeast UAS Airspace Integration Research Alliance, Inc. It's a very long name. So we go by New Air. It's much easier, New Air Alliance. We formed under the auspices of Center State CEO and Mass Development. Thank you. We formed the New Air Alliance about 3 years ago under CEO leadership and also a partnership with the Mass Development Corporation. We now have over 90 private, public, and academic partners that are involved in the development of UAS rules for integration into the national airspace system and promotion of industrial growth of the UAS sector. Next slide, please. This project goes back a long way. Congress heard the pleas of industry saying that, look, we really need to have some rules and regulations in the United States that allow for us to operate civilly and commercially unmanned aerial systems. Heretofore, it had really been the only the Department of Defense authorizations that were available and a few high-level federal law enforcement agencies. Congress passed the FAA Modernization and Reform Act in 2012. The President signed it on Valentine's Day of 2012. And in that act was a requirement for the FAA to establish 6 national test sites to gather data for the FAA to make the rules and regulations that are going to allow for full integration of unmanned aerial systems into the national airspace system. Next one, please. These are the 6 test sites. You can see ours, of course, is the only one in the Northeast, but they're located all across the country. Next slide, please. We are partnered with Griffiths International Airport. For those of you that are not familiar with Griffiths, it's an old B-52 base, so everything there is huge, as Billy Fischillo would say. And we've taken advantage of that space and the infrastructure of the airport to establish our main operating base for unmanned systems testing. What you see in the foreground is what we refer to as the triangle area. It's some old taxiways and runways that are not used anymore. We use that area for small UAS testing and the big 11,000-plus foot runway in the back for large UAS testing. Next slide, please. The top 3 pictures are pictures of various locations on Griffiths. Again, if you haven't been out to Griffiths, it's very well maintained. It is a great airport for us to use. It's a towered airport, which really allows us to test integration to the fullest extent. But our other 2 operating facilities are in Michigan and Massachusetts. On the left, lower left, is Alpena County Airport, where we do some testing in Michigan. And on the right is Joint Base Cape Cod, the former Otis Air Force Base on Cape Cod. So we are an airport-centric testing area. Some of our colleagues, some of the other of the 5 test sites are not airport-centric. They do other types of testing. Next slide, please. Now, everybody wonders what to call these things. You saw all the newscasters call them drones, and that's kind of the vernacular, but that's really not what it is. The little flying piece that you see, that's the unmanned aerial vehicle. And it is what everybody's focused on because that's what makes the news. But unmanned aerial system is really what we're all about. And it's important to understand that it is a full system operated by a human that entails not only the flying piece, but the communications piece and the software that run the communications and the flying part. I think the Europeans have done well. They call them remotely piloted aircraft systems, or RPAS. That describes fully what's going on. As I mentioned, the purpose of our test site is to gather information to provide to the FAA. We do that through testing. We take safety information, we give it to the FAA. They combine all of that with all the other safety information they're getting on unmanned systems, and that helps inform the rules that the FAA are going to promulgate for the operation of UAS and into the national airspace system. The picture is of the DelAirTech DT-18. That is operated by a company called Flyterra. And I'm happy to announce today that Flyterra has been our first company to take advantage of the Startup New York program at Griffiths International Airport. They are partnered with Mohawk Valley Community College. They've hired their first employee, and they're well underway. And why am I so excited about that? Not only does it prove the point that New York can be a friendly place for unmanned aerial systems, but if you'll notice, this fellow's standing in front of a vineyard. The DT-18 is one of its very missions is to provide vineyard owners with information so they know when it's the precise time to pick the grapes. And as a lover of red wine, that's an important mission for me. Next slide. When we put in our bid for one of these test sites, there were over 52 applicants across the country, down selected by the FAA as 25 qualified applicants, and finally 6 selected. We built our application on what is existing here in the central New York area, and one of the strongest points of our application was that the 174th Attack Wing at Hancock has been flying unmanned aerial systems and teaching unmanned aerial systems operations and maintenance for more than a decade. That really helped us, and it has helped us as New Air to build our employment force. So we've been very fortunate that we have been able to pick off a few retirees from the 174th to come over and be a part of the executive staff of New Air. Next slide, please. We're also partnered with Air Force Research Lab in Rome. We have what's called a cooperative research and development agreement with them. As many of you know, the Rome labs in particular are responsible for information security and cyber security research and development for the Air Force. That's an important factor in how unmanned aerial systems are going to be integrated into the national airspace system. What we don't want to see happen is someone with a cell phone hijack your package when Amazon's trying to deliver it with their drone. And Air Force Research Lab is helping us with that problem. Next slide, please. They have a facility at Stockbridge, New York, which has been testing avionics on aircraft for many years, and it's been a nice step for them to begin to look at unmanned aerial systems. Next slide, please. As I mentioned earlier, we are a true public-private partnership. New Air itself is a not-for-profit organization, and our partners include some of the companies that you see, some of the organizations that you see up there. Our three main supporters here in New York are obviously Lockheed Martin, Saab Census, SRC, Raytheon in Massachusetts, and some of the other companies, Calspans in Buffalo, Moog's in Buffalo, Allred & Associates is in Syracuse. We are, even though we are regionally based and headquartered in Syracuse, we are a true multi-state partnership. Next slide. Oh, excuse me, go back one if you can. But I wanted to give folks their real due, and I want everybody to sort of understand where this project originated. Somebody earlier mentioned Rob Simpson being involved with the Thursday Morning Roundtable at some point. Well, it was Rob Simpson, Center State CEO, Mohawk Valley Edge, which is the equivalent of CEO in the Mohawk Valley as far as economic development, and Mass Development Corporation that built the construct that became New Air that won the bid from the FAA. And why is that important? All of the other five test sites are either based on a university-driven model or on a state agency-driven model. We are not. We're built on a business development model. This is all about economic development for Central New York. And that's why we were led by those economic development organizations. Since we've gotten the award, New York Empire State Development has stepped in and also become a big player in the activities of the test site and the development of the unmanned aviation industry here in Central New York. Next slide, please. Our academic partners are many. We are led by, in New York, Rochester Institute of Technology, and in Massachusetts by Massachusetts Institute of Technology, but you can see we have many academic participants. You may wonder why Mohawk Valley Community College is in bold, the same bold as MIT and RIT, and the reason for that is Mohawk Valley Community College is instituting a drone curriculum training for students and going to add that on to their existing manned aircraft airframe and power plant training program that they have at Griffiths. No matter how the rules come out with unmanned systems, it's going to require training and education to build them, to maintain them, and to operate them. And Mohawk Valley Community College is leading the way in that regard. Next slide, please. Why did we do this? We did it for the money. For the money. This industry is predicted to reach $82 billion in total wealth by 2025. These are some of the other numbers that that are broken out, particularly for its impact on central New York, because as one of six test sites, we expect to lead the industry in growth and development. But just to show you that these numbers are not fictitious, the FAA only 8 months ago began to issue certificates that allow you to operate commercially. As of yesterday, and they kind of do this on their website like the old McDonald's, you know, 27 billion burgers sold, they have issued more than 1,700 commercial certificates, and they're issuing them at a pace of about 200 a week. That's just in the last 8 months since the opportunity has been there to commercially operate UAS in America. There is a huge pent-up demand, and I really believe that we'll exceed that $82 billion figure by 2025. Next slide, please. More numbers, because it was all about the money. It will impact central New York. I can tell you now that New Air, for example, didn't exist 3 years ago. We have 8 employees. Flyterra has taken advantage of the opportunity to establish a facility, their U.S. facility at Griffiths. And we, in the last 18 months, actually it's only been 12 months that we've been authorized to test. In the last 12 months, we, because of the testing activities, we have pumped well over $1 million in revenue into the community. And let me tell you how we do that. I'll just leave that slide up there for right now. You saw in the video two large-scale UAS operating. The Lockheed Martin K-MAX, which was the heavy lift helicopter that was doing the firefighting, and the Aurora Centaur, which was the twin-engine light twin that was being flown unmanned. When they came to test at Griffiths, they brought a crew of more than 10 people. They stayed in the local hotels, ate in the restaurants for a couple of weeks, and used the facilities, at which they paid for, by the way. We're a fee-for-service organization, which they paid for at Griffiths. That's the way this testing is starting to bring money into central New York. It's almost like UAS tourism. Next slide, please. Some of the things that have happened for us, we have participated in national trade shows, bringing more attention and more business to central New York. Through AUVSI, we've hosted two now industry days at Turning Stone. The first year we had about 120 participants. This year we had about 150 participants. We had over 50 businesses exhibiting, and we had national speakers that took the notice of what's going on here in central New York. So in addition to doing the testing, in addition to completing the science projects that are so necessary to integrate UAS into the national airspace system, we're also banging the drum for UAS business in central New York. Next slide, please. Just some more accomplishments. We happen to be proud of these things, so I have two pages of accomplishments. Next slide, please. How is all of this going to work? Well, first and foremost, we believe that in upstate New York in particular, unmanned aerial systems are going to impact in what's called precision agriculture. Cornell University is the leading university in New York for agricultural research for the use of drones. They have 7 COAs. They were our first one that we operated off of Farmers Field in Batavia. But I put this one up here because this is one of my favorite little drones. Weighs about 150 kilos. It's made by Yamaha. It's been in use in Japan for a long time. It can conduct precision agriculture spraying. It can put a spray pattern down to 1 square centimeter. Now think about that in controlling how you manage your crops. In addition to that, Deb Warner and I have been talking with Yamaha and bringing the RMAX to central New York to help with the mosquito situation in, what do you call that thing? Equine encephalitis. But this thing can just operate and operate and operate, lay down all kinds of precise spray patterns so it can go find where the mosquitoes are and X them out. Next slide. This was our very first test. This is a Cornell University precision agricultural test. That is what's called a Precision Hawk. It weighs about 5 pounds, and it is the neatest little gadget you have ever seen for farming. It's hand-launched. It's pre-programmed. It's, as they say, it's autonomous, but it's run by a human, obviously. So you pre-program this thing, you hand-launch it, it flies out to the center of the farmer's field, flies a couple of orbits to orient itself, then flies off to one corner of the field, flies its pattern, comes back and lands at the farmer's feet. Take the data, and then you can figure out where you have to water, where you have to put down pesticides, what's growing, what's not growing, what you have to do. All of that in just a matter of minutes on a fairly large field. Next slide, please. Additional uses that we anticipate to be sort of forerunners of Amazon delivering your package, certainly public safety. We've had a number of public safety-oriented tests. You saw the K-MAX. That was a firefighting test, one of the neatest tests going. Lockheed Martin builds both a small UAS called the Indigo. That was that little tiny one you saw flying with the C-5 in the background. And the K-MAX. So the Indigo acted as the bird dog. It flew out and found where the fire was, directed the K-MAX in. The K-MAX went and picked up the water and put out the fire. Those are the kinds of public safety activities that we're going to find more and more use of unmanned systems. You can think about how that helps. You don't expose a human to the danger, and you can precisely attack forest fires. You can look for missing individuals. You can do all kinds of things with UAS that you really can't do with either manned aircraft or humans. Next slide, please. Another good group of smart kids. We love the college kids. They're just so smart about this technology. They're absolutely the best at it. These are some kids from Harvard and MIT, and they have developed a drone that is going to deliver medicines to places that are completely unreachable by transportation that we have today. Next slide. These are the ones that are making the headlines, obviously. Amazon, Google, Facebook, all investing billions of dollars in research to develop unmanned systems. They see that as the wave of the future. We see that as the wave of the future. Google got into a bidding war for Titan Aerospace with Facebook and won. But these two, obviously, that's the package delivery drone that Amazon is promising. The one on the bottom is a high-altitude solar-powered drone model that can bring internet to areas that is completely underserved. So, for example, I was driving through the Adirondack Park the other day and was totally cell phone dead. If we'd had one of these in the air over the park, we'd have cell phone and internet. Next slide, please. This is a project by a Buffalo company called Moog. They are converting a manned helicopter, the Robinson R-44, to an unmanned or optionally piloted vehicle, primarily to be used in power line inspection, gas line inspection, those kinds of activities that are utilized today by manned helicopters. But there's always 4 or 5 accidents a year. It's a very dangerous mission, necessary to keep power going, but very dangerous. Next slide, please. So Moog is developing this remotely piloted system. But the reason that I picked these pictures goes way beyond just what Moog is doing for that one helicopter. For those of you that are like me, that are Star Wars aficionados, you remember this little tiny robot called R2-D2, you know, kind of a wise-ass, went around beeping, that sort of thing. Anyway, he sat in the back of the fighter plane, and he actually did the work. The robot did the work. The pilot sat up front just fixing his hair, you know, looking good. This little silver thing down here in this seat is the real R2-D2. It flies this helicopter start to finish with just a safety pilot on board. And R2-D2 doesn't have to fix his hair. Next slide, please. This is one of our favorite projects. We happen to be the first to operate a fully unmanned, and you can see there's no pilot in there, but it's in the air, a fully unmanned large UAS in the traffic pattern at Griffiths. And why is that important? Because we didn't close Griffiths Airport. We integrated through the tower the operation of this aircraft with every other aircraft that was flying around, all safely controlled by the control tower at Griffiths. That's what the future of aviation is going to look like. That's what integration really is. Next slide, please. At Griffiths, we're one of the few centers that is going to have what's called a range instrumentation system. We have drawn off the two local companies, SRC and Saab Census, to provide us with instrumentation that will allow for us to detect incoming UAS into the airport traffic area. Now, we're not allowed to shoot them down, but if there's a you've heard about all of these near misses, if you will, down at JFK and at other places, but we believe that our system will offer a prototype for other airports to get involved with being able to detect unmanned systems that are penetrating their airspace. In addition to that, for outbound unmanned systems, all airports are going to have to deal with this at some point. Unmanned large systems will be able to follow their progress from the ground all the way up to where they can be picked up by regular air traffic control, which is how they will get integrated into the National Airspace System. That's construction is underway, and we expect to beta test in November and be fully functional in January. Next slide, please. Just a quick, you heard what we have at Griffiths, but just note the K-MAX down in the lower right-hand corner. Because of the successful demonstration that Lockheed had at Griffiths, Command Corporation that makes the helicopter, Lockheed is the integrator of the software, Command is building six more of them to use for public safety, civil and commercial work. That's the kind of impact that the work we're doing here in Central New York is having on the economy. Next slide, please. Okay, here's probably the one that's on most people's minds. It is not the wild, wild west out there when it comes to drones. There are knuckleheads that operate that way, but there really is a scheme of regulations that control operations. An unmanned aerial system is an aircraft. Just like any other aircraft today, it comes under the full weight of FAA regulations. And so if your UAS, and believe me, no UAS can, even the largest, meet all of the requirements of FAA regulations for manned aircraft, if you want to operate, then you have to operate under what's called a waiver or exemption from the FAA. The FAA has responded for commercial operators of small UAS with what's called a Section 333 exemption. You may have read about that. That's the 1,700-plus and growing number that I mentioned. It has to do with small UAS, which, by the way, are 55 pounds or less, takeoff gross weight. And it allows for very limited commercial operations like aerial photography, power line inspections, and movie making, and some other activities. But that gives you an exemption from the rules that you would normally have to comply with in order to operate. It's a specialized exemption. You have to apply on a public docket to the FAA, and the FAA evaluates your exemption application and then determines whether or not you can do that. Then they give you authorization to act, and you have to act within the confines of that authorization, which is very limited. The other way that you can legally fly a UAS is under what's called a COA, Certificate of Authorization or Waiver. That's for public entities. That's what we have at Griffiths. We get COAs to operate. The way we do that is we submit an application to the FAA for the type of testing we want to do. The FAA reviews that, knows that it's safe, know that it's sound, and then they give us a COA to operate. But the COA is always limited under certain circumstances that we have to follow. So that's for a public entity, and that would also apply to your police force, search and rescue. Any government that's operating UAS will have to have a COA. Hobby operations. That's where part of the problem that we have today is. I read in Bloomberg the other day that there have been more than 435,000 UAS units sold in America since January of this year. almost all of those are non-commercial grade UAS that are being used by hobbyists. A hobbyist is just that, is strictly defined as flying one for a hobby or for recreation. If you're flying it for any other purpose, you have to either have a COA or a 333 exemption. So hobbyists are not regulated. There is, FAA has issued a new advisory circular, Advisory Circular 9157A, that lays out the constraints that they want the hobbyist to operate under. But the hobbyist can operate as they want to operate because they're not necessarily governed by rules and regulations. So that has created a problem, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. Lastly, the FAA issued back in February of this year a notice of proposed rulemaking that'll soon become Part 107 of the Federal Aviation Regulations that deals with all operations of aircraft, UAS aircraft, 55 pounds or less. Small. It's called the Small Rule for small UAS. There were over 45,000 comments made to the FAA on that proposed rulemaking. The FAA is obligated under the law to reconcile every one of those comments, so it has taken a while to do that, but we're hopeful the FAA will issue that rule pretty soon. That will sort of smooth out the operations that have now heretofore been done by exemption and waiver. There will actually be a rule in place. Next slide, please. However, in the meantime, and we support this fully, and for any of you that either know hobbyists that fly UAS, or you are a hobbyist that want to fly a UAS, or you're anybody that wants to fly a UAS, this is a layman's web page about what the rules and regulations are to fly. The limitations, it's called knowbeforeyoufly.org, supported by FAA, AUVSI, all of us that are in the business of UAS. We recommend this website for the new operators of UAS. Next slide, please. This event is over, but I put this in here to tell you that we're looking forward to next year. I hope you'll join us, but we've had two UAS industry days at Turning Stone now. Tremendous turnout. We are the largest, according to AUVSI, the largest UAS trade show in the Northeast. Next slide, please. Oops. This is just a cute one that I wanted to show you. That's the Indigo in the foreground, a little black quadcopter. That's what used to be the world's largest airplane in the background. The little quad weighs about 5 pounds. The aircraft is a C-5B, I believe it is, and it weighs about 650,000 pounds. But the beauty of this is this all happened at Griffiths Airport under the control of the tower. We didn't have to shut down the airport, and we integrated the operation of the Indigo with the activities of the giant C-5. Next slide. Same thing with the Centaur, the unmanned Centaur. You can see a manned Black Hawk landing in the background behind it. Next slide, please. And this one should be particularly interesting to you, because this is your airport. This is happening at Hancock right now. The MQ-9 is taxiing out, and the JetBlue is taxiing in. And that's what integration is going to look like. I had the privilege of giving a speech to airline executives out in Las Vegas about a month ago, and I put this slide up, and I thought the JetBlue guy was going to fall out of his chair. He said, man, I didn't realize it was here, but it is. Currently, the 174th is not allowed to fly the MQ-9 off of Hancock, but we are this close to getting authority. The FAA has already approved it under certain circumstances, and I think we're just waiting for FCC to approve the frequency allocation. So it's happening, it's here, and we are so happy to be a part of all of that for Central New York. Next slide, please. Okay. I think there's more on the program, but anyway, if you have any questions, comments, or cries of outrage, I'm here.
Thank you, Larry. We'll let him take a break. I'll pick some questions. I see we have George Kilpatrick in the audience. I wanted to tell you or remind you that George is going to be the MC at our TMR 50th anniversary event on October 14th. So if you haven't got your tickets paid for, if you haven't registered, do that soon.
Good morning. It's a lot of information about our new technology and stuff. My question goes to costs. Every time you have, this sounds like it's still obviously in advanced stages of R&D, but how practical it is in terms of cost for commercial use of a lot of these things, I guess. When do all those costs start coming down as any kind of new stuff hits the market?
Well, it's already starting to come down a little bit. You can get what is sort of a commercial level DJI Phantom, not that I'm promoting one brand over another, I'm just using that as an example, for about $1,200. And we are working with a couple of universities that are operating DJI Phantoms that are doing some pretty significant proof of concept testing for agricultural purposes and bridge inspections and those kinds of things. To be honest with you, the marketplace in America is just developing. So units are still pretty expensive relative to what you could buy a used airplane for example. But that's really changing rapidly. And it's because there's a marketplace developing. Remember, I told you there's 1,700 now authorized commercial vendors, if you will, in the United States. And that has really changed the dynamic just in the past year of the pricing.
Good morning. I really enjoyed the technological description that you have given. I see great promise for what I'm going to call drones. It's the easiest thing for me. But I do wonder about two particular areas. One is the use of drones for surveillance here in this country. And that is two parts. One, naturally, government, but also private people who fly over private property that is not theirs and are looking at what's going on down below. And the second main area would be the drones being used internationally for weapons of mass destruction. Naturally, mass destruction in a small area, but they are thought by many of us to be illegal on international law. Can you comment on both of those areas?
Well, I'll comment on the second one first. We're not involved in Department of Defense use of unmanned systems at all. We are only involved in civil and commercial use. So I really don't know what to tell you about the rules of engagement for unmanned systems that are operated by Defense Department. The other part, though, I can talk to, and that is essentially the privacy issue of utilization of drones. Drones are nothing more than a tool. The law looks at them that way, just like a tool. So if I am a law enforcement officer and I want to use a drone to conduct surveillance, I'll have to get a warrant because it's no different than if I used my telephoto camera lens, my binoculars, or even my naked eyeball. So law enforcement use of a drone is really no different than use of any other type of technology. If they're going to use it for wiretap purposes, they have to get a warrant. Private citizens are governed by the laws that govern activities of all of us. Drone is just a piece of technology. It's a tool. If I go to Home Depot and I buy a hammer and I use it to build a house for Habitat for Humanity, I'm a candidate for Man of the Year. If I take that same hammer, that same tool, and I break the glass on your back door and come in and steal your big screen TV, I'm going to go to the penitentiary. Same hammer. You know, we don't make laws against hammers. We make laws against people who do bad things with hammers. And it's the same thing with drones. They're not, just because it's new technology doesn't mean it has some sort of exception under the law.
You had a question, I think.
Yes, a bit of a corollary to this last question. There seems to be laws, there seems to be regulation, but quite frankly, I mean, the knuckleheads, as you say, are someone with bad intent. There's no way to trace these things or people. Is there anything in the offing about putting a chip in these things or whatever and having people register them and so on?
Absolutely. If you're operating one today under a commercial authority or under a COA public authority, you have to register your craft with the FAA just like you register your airplane. If you're a hobbyist, you do not. That's the issue. That's where you are. And we are looking at, and in fact, Senator Schumer is one of the leading voices in the country on technology requirements for drone manufacturers that might include an identification chip, or in Senator Schumer's case, he's a big fan of mandating geofencing, which says that the manufacturer has to build into the drone a program so it won't fly over the White House, for example. And I'm here to tell you, we just did our first test about a month and a half ago on a small UAS that had geofencing technology. This was an inspection of a natural gas transfer plant that was right next to the throughway. And so we set it up so that it would only inspect the plant and not fly over the throughway. And as it began to approach the throughway, the technology moved it back. So the test was successful. But, yes, there are, and that is an issue that many people are aware of. Now, I will say this. I'm not Irish, but I danced a little jig of happiness the other day when I saw that the knucklehead that crashed his drone into the stadium for the U.S. Open was immediately arrested by local police. I've seen more stories like that. Police are taking a more aggressive posture. So you're right, it's hard to trace it, but if we do, spend some time in jail.
Would you stand up?
Good morning. My question follows a similar vein and having to do, we have to register guns to make a purchase, and I'm wondering if that kind of situation has been discussed among the lawmakers.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, if you're operating a UAS commercially or civilly as a public authority, you have to register that aircraft with the FAA. The way aircraft are registered is through the National Aircraft Registry in Oklahoma City run by the FAA. And also, if your aircraft happens to weigh more than 12,500 pounds, you have to put it in the global registry, which is in South Africa. But that was that process is set up to do just that, to trace the buying and selling of certain aircraft. That aircraft becomes identified after the manufacturer makes it by its end number. The challenge is going to be for aircraft that are not required to be registered, operated by hobbyists. There is no manufacturer requirement at the moment to build any sort of identification mechanism in there. There is no requirement for me to have a background check at the moment. However, that proposed rule, Part 107, that I showed you that the FAA has proposed, one element of that rule is that in order for you to operate a UAS civilly, you have to have a TSA background check.
I'm going to avoid the surveillance issue, but ask you, Larry, to talk a little bit about the context within which UAVs have been developed in terms of broader geographic technologies and what potential that also has for development in Central New York, given the vast need here. For example, you mentioned your partnership with RIT and Mohawk Community College, for example. Both of those also have broader geographic information technology programs at those institutions. And we know that we have excellence here at the corporate level, and we have a great need at the governing level to apply those technologies. And by that, I mean remote sensing, where precision ag has been used for over a decade. You know, this is augmenting existing. LIDAR is another huge application area. I don't know how many people here are familiar with it. We had a presentation by Bob Murrett, a former director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency of DOD, a few months back, and that's representative GPS, computer mapping, mm-hmm. remote sensing. How are you developing that? So we're looking at, you know, rather than the negative sides of this technology, but how it can be helpful, particularly in an area where we don't even have GPS on our public works vehicles.
Wow. Okay. Here's the deal. It's an unmanned aerial system, and what that has done for us is open up a broad base of technology. We've been focused initially on flight safety. That's it. Flight safety is all that we've been focused on. But as we are moving to more development of integration into the national airspace system, we're more focused on the software that runs the UAS, the communication system that talks to the UAS, and the sensor packages that the UAS can fly. To your point directly, and I'll use RIT as an example. RIT, many of you may know that it was Kodak that was the funding stream and the startup of RIT. And so RIT has contained within its walls some of the best work that's being done on photo sensing kinds of activities. So a really smart guy at RIT has come up with a sensor technology that he believes can fit on a UAS and really help with crop management. So we're working some testing where we're integrating his sensor package on a Lockheed Martin built UAS to see how all of that's going to work. Now, but one thing I want to bring up, her point is well taken. Central New York has some of the best and most experienced companies in the development of radar and air traffic control devices. Saab Sensus builds what's called a wide area multilateration sensor system, which is an FAA-approved air traffic control system that's in place at dozens of airports around the world. SRC builds what's called the L-STAR radar, which is the Army's selected radar for UAS ground-based sense and avoid. What's happening is, I'll use SRC as an example, they created a whole company called Griffin Sensors to do nothing but work on taking that technology that SRC has developed for military use and augmenting it into civil use. Those are the kinds of technology partnerships and activities that this work with the UAS test site has developed.
Thank you so much for such an informative presentation. My question is, does NewAir have or might develop a newsletter for your neighbors here in Central New York, because we all are so very interested in what's happening?
Well, we're six steps behind on updating our website because things are happening so quickly. And by the way, that's my caveat that I tell every audience that I speak to. What I've told you today is appropriate today. Check with me tomorrow, because that's just how fast things are changing. So I would encourage you to follow us on our website. We're getting better at putting informative content on there. And I suggest to you that my commitment is public education is a big part of how this industry is going to develop. That's why I go everywhere I can and talk to anybody that I can about the industry, because once the public has a widespread acceptance of this technology, then the commercial activity will really grow. Amazon will be delivering packages, Domino's will be delivering pizza, and SRC and Saab Sensus will have developed the ground control system to keep them from running into each other at the corner. So please check our website, www.newairalliance.org.
Hello, I'm a hobbyist, actually, and so I just want to point out one observation. Most of us are members of clubs.
Yes.
And we fly at approved sites, and we follow those, you know, rules that the FAA has. But, you know, that's just an observation. I'm more concerned about the commercial link and safety in commercial aircraft. So, I mean, most aircraft fly with autopilot. Are you working with, the commercial industry to introduce more safety features through this automated control?
Absolutely. We had two ALPA, for those of you who don't know what ALPA is, it's the Airline Pilots Association, essentially that is the union for airline pilots that for most of, like 95% of all the airlines out there. We had two of their safety representatives observing the Centaur test, and we spent 2 days with them talking, exchanging ideas about what has to happen to be safe. The real safety issue is how do we avoid uncooperative aircraft? And I don't mean uncooperative in a negative sense. I just mean uncooperative in that they are not participating in the air traffic control system. And they don't have to, by the way. The rules allow for manned aircraft to fly in certain pieces of airspace without talking to anybody, without telling anybody they're there. Because the number one rule of manned aircraft is see and avoid. The pilot is obligated to see obstacles and avoid them. That's what's missing in the UAS technology. That's what we're all working on, is to try to come up with a way to see and avoid. Now, clearly it's not going to be a person on the drone. It's going to have to be some electronic means to do that. But we're getting closer and closer. It's now called detect and avoid, by the way. Remember, I told you things change. Called detect and avoid, and NASA, who we now have a contract with, is getting into the game. The first A in NASA stands for aeronautics, and they're getting into this in a big way to help develop that very thing, the technology that will go on UAS to detect and avoid.
We all know that California is experiencing record droughts and disastrous wildfires, and I'm wondering if this technology is being used there, or if it isn't, is it because of that regulations are behind, or manufacturing is behind, or technology isn't up to snuff?
Let me see how I can say this without making a lot of people mad. It's being used, but it's not being used fully. And the reason it's not being used fully is because the regulations are behind. The National Guard, a couple of years ago, was given some special permission out in California to operate and support the firefighting effort on the California Rim Fire. Great success. Unfortunately, the Department of Defense now has clamped down and said, no more, until we get this integration system worked out. Lockheed Martin has taken their firefighting helicopter out to Idaho and is participating with the Department of the Interior in working some firefighting efforts out there, but it's not full scale, simply because the regulations have not been fully developed.
Okay. One more quick question, very quick.
As a former pilot yourself, I just wondered if you had mixed feelings about unstaffed or remotely piloted aircraft, and if this is going to be putting pilots out of work.
Well, I don't think it'll be putting pilots out of work because at that same speech that I gave out in Las Vegas to the airline executives, the guy before me was talking about the impending pilot shortage. So I got up and I introduced him to R2-D2, so that might fix that problem. And as a pilot, how do I feel about it? You know, I have to tell you, they're much better than I ever was. When the Centaur flew its unmanned traffic pattern at Griffiths, it was amazingly stable, much more stable than I have ever been. You know, I mean, let's face it, as a human, I'm constantly flying the airplane, correcting back to where I should be. I mean, that's what pilots do. This airplane, steady as a rock, came down the glide slope on the ILS perfectly. And admittedly, it was a light wind day. It was only about 5 knots of wind. But landed dead on the center line, taxied in. I thought, man, that's the way to go.
Thank you, Larry Brinker, New Air Alliance.
Thank you all very much. Appreciate it.